Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Governor Andrew Cuomo's budget office is temporarily withholding 20% of state aid payment owed to several cities in New York, citing the COVID-19 pandemic-related revenue shortfall and budget deficit plaguing state government. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Cuomo and his budget director have been saying for months that if Congress does not provide another relief package for state and local governments hard hit by the effects of the pandemic, then the state will have to cut funding to schools, hospitals, and cities by one-fifth. The first sign of following through with that plan came this week. That's when several cities with fiscal years beginning July 1 learned that they would temporarily be getting only 80% of the amount allotted to them in the state budget. Those cities include Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, White Plains, and Yonkers. The 12 cities were to have received over $370 million in state aid. Instead, they'll get just under $300 million. Peter Baines with the New York Conference of Mayors says the loss comes on top of other fiscal hardships caused by the coronavirus-related economic shutdown, and cities are already scrambling.
Just based on the estimated 20% drop in sales tax revenue over the course of the entire year for these cities, I mean, virtually every city's talking about furloughs and potentially layoffs.
A spokesman for the governor's budget division, Freeman Kloppet, says in a statement that the reduction should not be viewed as a permanent cut. He says they're holding back 20% of what is owed because the state faces a cash crunch from steep revenue losses caused by the pandemic and the federal decision to delay income tax filings until July 15th. Governor Cuomo, in a news conference, says there's still time to wait for Congress to act before he has to propose permanent cuts. He says right now, there's no hard deadline.
So the drop-dead date is what you declare in some ways. If you conclude that the federal government is not going to provide any aid, period, and these are the numbers, then you would act on those numbers. But we're not there yet.
Democrats in the House of Representatives passed a $3 trillion aid package that would help bail out the state and local governments. Republicans who control the U.S. Senate have objected to it, though. Cities, by law, are not allowed to run a deficit, so Bain says they will have to make adjustments now.
The uncertainty at this time of the fiscal year creates all kinds of problems because they're going to have to borrow money or transfer money temporarily to fill the hole in their budgets, and they don't know when the temporary period is going to end. They don't know if it's a week, a month, or whether they, down the road, may be told they'll never receive the aid.
For now, the state legislature's hands are tied when it comes to the temporary cuts. If the governor's budget office decides to propose making the cuts permanent, then lawmakers have 10 days to accept the plan or come up with an alternative. That's under rules set up in the current state budget. Many Democrats in the state Senate and Assembly favor raising taxes on the wealthy instead of cutting aid. But as long as the funding reductions are temporary, the legislature does not have the power to act. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gastina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer, Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, Governor Andrew Cuomo,
who you spoke to, often says he's leaving politics out of it, but he went right after the president, went after the federal government's handling of this, said the president can do two things. First, sign an executive order directing everyone to wear a mask. Then let the president lead by example and let the president put a mask on because we know it works. We've proven that it works in the state of New York.
David, what am I going to say except that the governor is absolutely right in this? The president should issue those orders because we're being told that we have now reached the tipping point in the United States where this thing will never be controlled. And therefore, Cuomo's right. He says it's not political. Of course it's political. The fact of the matter is that this president is being political in the sense that he thinks if he takes the con, C-O-N, on this, he will be seen, you know, as the logical guy, and it's not working as more and more people get sick in the United States. We are hearing from experts that up to 50% of the people, maybe more, in this country will end up with this virus. And he's going to go down in history as one of the people who really messed up as president.
Well, Alan, this week you spoke with Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group, about the primaries that we just held in a pandemic and the voting by mail that's happened. We haven't even seen yet the full results of many of these races, but he wrote a column in which, you know, he pointed out, how did it go? Well, not so great, he said.
Well, we can tell it's not so great. We also have some other elections coming up. We do know that many of the people who are at the polls, poll watchers or the people who are helping people to vote, those people are older and therefore most at risk and therefore scared to come out. So you have this whole idea of voting by mail, which is not easy because you have to have the counters doing it all. But then you also have the people who want to go to the polls and real problems there. There is a lot of work to be done here. We can figure this out. We're the greatest country in the world. We have the ability to look at and see what needs to be done and to do it. We've always done it. This is a time to do that.
We're seeing the governor put an edict out recently to all cities in the state to work on police reform, and many have already instituted forms of that, as has the state. The issue of defund the police is a big one, and what that actually means. We've seen quite a fight in New York City, and the mayor and officials there moving to do just that, strip about $1 billion away from the police department.
Well, we're waiting to see if Andrew Cuomo gets his way, David. And he may, which is that the federal government will come up and give the money to the states and the cities so that their very deficient funds can be replenished. And we won't face, for example, in New York State, a $16 billion shortfall. And I have a feeling it's more than that. But, you know, this governor, Cuomo, has to somehow balance the budget. That's the rules. That's the way it goes. He has not been willing to say, we're not going to plan in case we don't get that money. His assumption is we're going to get it. He's enlisted Nancy Pelosi, the House of Representatives. They've come up with a HEROES Act. In the HEROES Act, there is money for the states. He's counting on the fact we're going to get it. If we don't get it, well, just imagine, instead of having 30 kids disgraceful in a class, you may have 50, and you may be firing 20% of your workforce. They're already furloughing people. So New York state government is really now at the point where we have to hope that the federal government will come along. The House of Representatives has already done it, and the Senate will too.
Well, Blair addressed one way to take a huge chunk out of that $16 billion deficit you mentioned, which is the stock transfer tax to the tune of $15 billion that could go to the state.
Hey, David, we've heard this tune before. We have to come up with the money, and one of the ways is going to be the stock transfer tax. We all know that it's great for New York to have the stock exchange, but they can pick up and go to New Jersey. That's what governors have always worried about. So, David, it's got to come from somewhere.
Right. And you continued that conversation, because if they don't, let's say, get the federal money, the issue will be, how do you raise the revenue? And you've got two African-American leaders. You have Carl Hastie, the Assembly Speaker, and Andrew Stewart Cousins, the Senate leader. And they're talking about raising the possibility of raising taxes on the rich.
Well, that's right. That's always been the case. Now, Cuomo, who is, when it comes to those things, is more of a moderate than they are, or at least that Hastie is not likely to want that. So if you were a fly on the wall in the room when the two men and the one woman get together, it used to be called the three men in the room. It's not anymore, thank goodness. And they get together and there's going to be some yelling and screaming, I suspect. Cuomo does not want to damage the economy of New York for what it is right now by making people flee, particularly people who have the most. But I may be wrong about that. He may say it's got to come from somewhere.
And then that leads you to think about the popularity that he's engendered as a result of how he's handled the COVID-19 crisis in New York, and even more so now that you see New York going way down and reopening while many of the states around the country are becoming hotspots. And you've got to imagine that through a budget negotiation with the state in deficit, depending on what happens, you could strip away a lot of that well-earned popularity.
Well, David, he was at 75, he's at 65. I'll tell you where the 10% went. That went on the impression in some people's minds that his work on nursing homes was not sufficient. There's a body of thought that he knew what he was talking about when he said, look, those people with COVID have to go somewhere. You got to take them nursing homes. Well, anybody with a relative in a nursing home didn't like that one bit. And the nursing homes didn't like it one bit. I think that he realizes that may have been at least a political misstep, maybe not in terms of what was right, but it was a step that cost him a couple of percents.
And he keeps coming out. The issue, of course, is compliance. You can't have a flattening of the curve and continue to keep the disease at bay if people aren't cooperating. And in New York, he's added 8 more states to the quarantine list for when they come to New York. How in the heck are you going to keep this virus out of New York if the rest of the country blows up?
Well, that's right. Our numbers in New York are low now, but, you know, the possibility of reinfection has got to be very much on the governor's mind. The so-called W effect, it goes down, it's high, it goes down to the floor, and then it goes up again. And look, you know, you can tell people you can't come to the state if you're coming from Florida. Yeah, good. There will be those people who don't listen, and they will infect others. So there is always the possibility of a reinfection, that's for sure. And he's wise to be talking about that as much as he can.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Between now and April 2021, New York communities are being asked to reinvent their police departments under a directive issued by Governor Andrew Cuomo. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard recently asked public officials in Schenectady for their thoughts on the policy.
After weeks of protests nationwide against police brutality, Governor Cuomo and the Democrat-led New York State Legislature passed the Say Their Name agenda, which allows for greater transparency of police personnel records, bans chokeholds by police, prohibits false race-based 911 calls, and codifies an existing executive order to give the state attorney general authority to investigate fatal police encounters. Speaking on WAMC on June 15th, Governor Cuomo said he wouldn't tell communities what their police should look like.
But you have to come up with a redesign plan with everybody at the table. You have to pass it through a legislative, so it's not a dictatorial exercise, and it has to be done in 9 months.
Communities that do not comply risk losing state funding. Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy recently announced an executive order that would ban police use of chokeholds and knee-to-neck holds, requires officers to intercede and report all uses of force, and mandates training requirements for de-escalation, implicit bias, and systemic racism. McCarthy has said the order underlines practices already used by the Schenectady Police Department. During a press conference Wednesday, WAMC asked McCarthy about the governor's calls to reimagine the police.
The recent events have created a greater focus on it, but Schenectady has been part of that on an ongoing basis in terms of community policing outreach and just trying to do innovative things that better leverage public safety dollars and get greater buy-in from the community so that they respect police officers, that they respect firefighters, they respect public employees in the services that are delivered by this city.
Police Chief Eric Clifford said he's having conversations that relate to every aspect of the governor's directive.
From training, from policy reviews, and then conversation with community members. We've been out there meeting with the community members, and we're looking forward to assembling a group, as the governor directed, of community members, stakeholders, that can give us feedback on what they would like to see.
The city says the Schenectady Police Department collects and analyzes use of force data daily. Clifford said restrictions caused by the coronavirus pandemic have made it difficult to schedule an in-person police community meeting. That sentiment was echoed by Karen Zalewski-Wildzunis, a member of the all-Democratic Schenectady City Council.
You know, once we kind of get everything squared away with this pandemic, we'll start having some more in-person meetings, and we'll see what can come of it. But I'm very supportive of Chief Clifford and what he's been doing so far.
Councilor Marion Porterfield looks forward to more dialogue about how to improve policing in a city with a troubled past.
There's some basic intimidation, frankly, that people feel, that I think that we can together work and change that, because all of us want the same thing. We want a safe community. We want the police to be there to protect and to serve. And, you know, we just want, you know, people not to be afraid so that when the police are called, that it's a negative outcome. So we will be working together to make sure that that happens. And there's, as you, I'm sure you know, many, many groups that have a voice at the table. So all of those voices will need to come together and come up with a plan that really works for our city.
Like other Capital Region communities, Schenectady has an independent civilian police review board. The board may report to the city council or mayor, but does not have subpoena power, nor is it allowed to participate in internal investigations.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
A liberal arts college in the Lower Hudson Valley is offering a new course this summer for incoming freshmen on COVID-19. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn spoke with one of the professors who helped create the course.
Manhattanville College Sports Studies professor Dr. Amy Bass says the course aims to help students make sense of the pandemic across a range of disciplines.
We're offering it to them 2 credits, free of charge, a collaboration of almost 30 faculty, and one of the first colleges in the nation to do this, to tackle COVID as a learning opportunity. I think that what we really wanted to do was come off of what was a really tough semester. You know, we all of us in the world of higher ed had to migrate online suddenly and under terrible circumstances. And we wanted to reconnect, and we wanted to, you know, think about coming into college as all of this is happening. How can we best care for our incoming first-year students?
She says the idea came from a group of 5 educators who were meeting about an initiative on interdisciplinary collaboration.
These couple of hours every week that we met to have these interdisciplinary conversations were sort of a highlight for us. So we kept doing it, and we started talking about COVID and how COVID-19 couldn't be understood just by the biologist in our group, or just by me, who's a historian by training, or an art historian, that the conversations that we had together didn't just offer perspectives from each of our fields, but created new knowledge for each of us in a new way that we couldn't do without one another. So then we started having conversations about the incoming first years and what that was going to be like. You know, beginnings should be exciting. Beginnings should be filled with, you know, anticipation. So how can we look at the moment that we're in right now and create something exciting for students, something that is supportive of students?
The course, which contains 4 online modules, begins the week of July 6th and includes online discussion forums and weekly live sessions with a faculty member.
I'm doing an introductory keynote, which is called A Game of Inches, What Sport Reveals About the Age of COVID-19. And I'm sort of starting with the NBA shutting down, because it was a critical turning point, I think, for Americans to say, hey, basketball just got shut down. We might need to sit up and pay attention to this. And then looking at other ways that sports help us understand moments like this. We have a module that's focused on the past, making meaning from things like the bubonic plague and the art and literature. And this is a fascinating module. I was riveted by this module because it showed in so many ways how folks centuries ago had the same kind of emotions and the same kind of feelings that we do now, the isolation, the devastation, the worry. We have a module that sort of helps us navigate finding facts and finding good reporting in the world of social media and 21st century media. And this is a really fun module that looks at a lot of the memes that have been developed about COVID-19 that are out there in various social media platforms. And so we have scientists and social media experts sort of in dialogue with each other, unpacking those things. We have a group looking at how we've seen inequalities revealed in stark spotlights by something like a global pandemic. And then the last module is about coping and caring. And this brings together two units of the Manhattanville community. One of our most storied units, that of the education program, the School of Education, and our newest folks, and that is the School of Nursing and Healthcare Sciences. And so bringing those two groups together to talk about, alongside others, psychology, communication, and media folks, to talk about coping and empathy and creativity and even activism. How can we empower ourselves and our students to really think about compassion as a mode of action and making changes in our communities? And then we end with sort of a bring everybody together, and our president, Michael Geisler, is going to have a conversation for the students to look at, you know, everything that they've discovered over the course of the four modules, and then transition and welcome them as a community who has hopefully gotten to know each other a little bit and us a little bit before starting the fall semester.
Manhattanville's president expects in-person instruction to begin August 31st for the fall semester, ending November 23rd. Students will not return to campus after Thanksgiving, and the remaining 3 weeks of the fall semester and final exams will be completed remotely.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government, politics. I'm David Gustina. The Business Council of New York State coordinated with Chambers of Commerce and other groups to offer a recent seminar on racial inclusion, diversity, and equality in business. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley tuned in to the virtual presentation.
The panelists that discussed issues facing Black business owners and employees included representatives from the Business Council, the New York Conference of the NAACP, and the group 100 Black Men of New York. Business Council President and CEO Heather Bersetti said in the wake of protests and growing awareness about systemic racism, the council wanted to not only address the issue, but work toward action and change.
We wanted to talk about and actually take action on what can be done to recognize and address company culture that can be problematic. How do we get companies to recognize that there is talent among Black professionals and give better opportunities? What can we do to help Black-owned businesses and ensure that they have equal access to finance and opportunities on a level footing with all business?
NAACP New York Economic Development Chair Gary Johnson says equal opportunities in economic development are game changers for communities of color.
We are at an inflection point in history, and that inflection point is the confluence of at least three things: this pandemic, the economic upheaval that it's caused, and the social unrest because of the inequities that African Americans have for the last 400 years in the United States. And the sore is bare. So now is the time to take this inflection point and set a new course. And that new course has to start with awareness.
National Black MBA New York Chapter immediate past president Michelle McCleary says employers must be willing to change their employment structure to give people of color more opportunity to enter management positions.
There's some simple things that corporations can do. For instance, stop using LinkedIn to recruit, because that gives your recruiters too much of an opportunity to have their unconscious bias have an impact on who you hire. Change the focus of your career development. So if your career development focus is on upper management and it's 99% white, you will never move black and brown people up that corporate ladder. You have to be willing to turn that on its head.
While much of the conversation focused on larger corporate style companies, Bersetti was asked about the challenges of recruiting people of color to rural areas, to which 100 Black Men of New York President Michael Garner responded.
In the sparsely populated rural Adirondacks, it's very hard to recruit people of color to come here because there are so few people of color here. Any thoughts?
Qualified Blacks will go where the opportunities are.
If you can create an environment where that professional is going to feel supported, nobody's looking for a handout, and can move up the ladder, people will go there.
Audio is courtesy of the Business Council of New York State. A link to the full seminar is at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2027. Or just listen to our podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.